Case number 08-5422. Emily's List, Appellant versus Federal Election Commission. Mr. Bauer for the appellant, Mr. Kolker for the appellee.
If it please the court, I'm Robert Bauer. I'm counsel for Emily's List. This is a case about regulations that impede the activities of an independent, non-connected political committee, which has a long history of supporting successfully candidates for state and local, as well as candidates for federal office. And as we hope to show here, the Federal Election Commission, in the guise of regulating federal election activities, has invaded the sphere of what Emily's List can do and has done for over a quarter of a century in recruiting and promoting women candidates to state and local office. Now, in regulating federal elections, the court the courts have made clear that the Federal Election Commission is compelled to consider the nature of an organization, the nature of its activities, and the relationship of those activities to an established, approved, compelling governmental interest. And here the agency disregarded this analysis in its entirety. First of all, it disregarded the nature of Emily's List. It brought to bear what was essentially a political party analysis to a non-connected independent committee, which is not under the control of or associated with candidates in the fashion of a political party. It has a long history of supporting state and local candidates, a long history of supporting federal candidates, but its state and local commitment is clear on the record in this case.
How does it support federal candidates? It gives direct contributions.
It provides direct contributions to those candidates, and it also works to recruit candidates to federal office and support candidates that share its programs.
When you say support candidates there, does it run ads that expressly advocate the election of particular federal candidates?
Yes, it does.
Okay. And then it does get out the vote, voter.
Correct.
Voter registration.
That is correct.
What else? I'm just kind of interested in the universe of things it does. So contributions, ads. Does it do issue ads?
No, typically not, Your Honor.
Typically not, okay. That's get out the vote, voter registration.
That's correct. Okay. So it engages in those activities, but it engages those in activities at both the federal and also at the non-federal level. And there's been no suggestion in this case that its state and local program is somehow a ruse, that somehow in some fashion Emily's List supports state and local candidates as a cover for bringing so-called soft money into the federal elections process.
Can I ask you a question? This might be a little bit of a tangent, but suppose Emily's List only did get out the vote, voter registration, issue ads, say, and did not contribute directly to federal candidates, and it didn't do ads that supported expressly the election of federal candidates. Could the federal government, consistent with the First Amendment, regulate contributions or expenditures by Emily's List under that hypothetical at all?
Well, it certainly could to some extent, to be sure, if it tailored the regulation to the federal election-related impact of Emily's List activities. But, for example, as the record in this case shows, there'll be circumstances in which Emily's List will conduct get out the vote or other ticket-wide promotional activities in a year in which there is no federal candidate on the ballot. And the Federal Election Commission has to take into account in its rules that there are circumstances in which the state and local activities in which the committee engages in are really quite pure, and there's no potential impact to speak of, nothing but a hypothetical and, in this case, highly conjectural impact on federal elections. Now, beyond disregarding the independent nature of Emily's List's activity, that it is not a political party but an independent committee with its long commitment to state and local elections, the Federal Election Commission also disregarded the nature of the activities in which Emily's List engaged, and Your Honor just raised some of those questions with us. But before the court in this case, we have rules that have an extraordinary impact on some of Emily's List state and local activities, and I would like to very briefly identify some of them, which are undisputed on the record. Emily's List, for example, frequently recruits federal election federal elected officials and federal candidates, superstar candidates in some cases, which have national recognition, to help promote its state and local programs. And as Emily's List brought before the FEC, it would like to use those very high-profile federal candidates to make appeals to voters outside those candidate states, and even in years in which those candidates are not running for federal office, to bring to bear their celebrity, their recognition, to help Emily's List reach out to voters and support the state and local candidates that Emily's List supports. And yet the Federal Election Commission takes the position that even if a Michigan United States senator appeals to voters in North Dakota in a year in which he's not running for election to support state and local candidates, the mere reference to that federal candidate in that communication, the mere presence of the federal candidate in that communication, is sufficient to require Emily's List to pay 100% of that communication with hard money. Likewise, in a year in which there are no federal candidates on the ballot, if Emily's List funds an appeal to Democratic voters as a class to support its slate of state and local candidates, the mere reference to the political party, even in that non-federal election year, is sufficient under FEC rules to require the communication to be paid for with 50%, no less than 50% hard money. If a federal candidate under FEC rules is brought in to endorse ballot initiatives that Emily's List is supporting at the state and local level, the mere presence of the federal candidate or federal official in endorsing those ballot initiatives requires under FEC rules Emily's List to pay for the cost with 50% hard money. So here we have the FEC disregarding the nature of the activity, its relationship to federal election activity. And furthermore, as a third prong of, I think, the FEC's failures in this case in shaping this particular rule, the FEC does not ground these rules in a recognized compelling interest. The Supreme Court has made it very clear there has to be a nexus to corruption or the appearance of corruption, something the rule accomplishes in that regard. But here what the FEC is essentially doing—
I would argue against any regulation of a group like Emily's List, right?
It would only argue against the regulation of a group like Emily's List where the regulation is so sweeping, it goes beyond that legitimate targeted interest in preventing corruption and spills over into the sphere of its legitimate support of state and local candidates.
The interest in preventing corruption could go to the extent Emily's List funds candidates. That has to be expended out of a federal account. But beyond that, how does the corruption interest support any regulation of a group like Emily's List that's not a party and not a candidate committee?
Well, if Emily's List is, under the current doctrine, as I think the FEC might read it and read it fairly, if Emily's List is engaged in federal election activities, if it's making contributions or independent expenditures, if it's promoting federal candidates directly, then the FEC, to enforce the basic statutory scheme of contribution and spending limits and disclosure related to federal elections and related to the prevention of corruption, in those circumstances, the FEC has some range of regulatory authority, but it's not unbounded. It can't regulate as it pleases. It can't strike in all directions wildly, which is what has done here.
Would your position preclude, say, regulation of get-out-the-vote drives or voter registration or that sort of thing? Do you think that would be beyond the FEC's purview?
No, Your Honor, we don't take that position. We take the position that reasonable regulations to account for the federal election-related impact of that activity are permissible. But as I mentioned to Judge Kavanaugh a minute ago, there are circumstances in which the Federal Election Commission has insisted that even in a year in which there are no federal candidates on the ballot, it can enforce very harsh federal financing requirements, which deny Emily's List the ability to operate in states in support of state and local candidates under the rules that the states themselves have prescribed for the financing of their own elections. Now, the FEC having apparently worried here, though impermissibly, that there was a basis for concern about circumvention, has created nothing even in the record to support it. There is nothing in this record, and I think it's important that we emphasize this to the court, that indicates even a whiff of a question that Emily's List program has threatened in any way the integrity of federal elections in the fashion that the Supreme Court has defined it. There's no allegation of cheating by non-connected committees as a class.
This didn't come out of something with Emily's List, but this came out of the problem with, is it ACT, in the 04 election?
It came out of two pieces. There are two acronymic committees here, ABC and ACT.
Right.
ABC never really existed. It was a shell organization that brought its case before the FEC to see whether it could move the rules in a particular direction. ACT, or ACT, was a non-connected committee, but there are two points to be made about that. First of all, the commission came belatedly to the argument that the rules that we're discussing here were necessary because of ACT. And secondly, its own actions toward ACT demonstrate that the rules we have before us were not necessary to deal with ACT because the FEC apparently had at hand, within its existing regulatory toolkit before these rules were enacted, more than enough enforcement authority to deal with ACT, with which it indeed dealt. And in fact, ACT paid a very substantial penalty by settlement with the FEC at the conclusion of an investigation that began around 2004.
The ACT, I guess it's ACT example, ACT shows that the FEC doesn't need new rules. It just needs to enforce the rules that were already in place, including the funds expended.
Correct, Your Honor. It did not need these rules. It did not need new rules. But in particular, it did not need rules like these, which sweep so broadly.
What about the idea that this is much easier to comply with, that there was a lot of confusion before, a lot of uncertainty about how to sort out particular funds from particular accounts?
We're here to tell this court that Emily's List has never been confused by the rules that it was required to comply with, nor was it frankly consulted directly to determine whether or not it was burdened in any way in complying with the rules that were in effect prior to these. This explanation that the FEC hurriedly developed, that it was in effect helping political committees by putting them under this onerous new regulatory regime, was both late in the game and highly unconvincing. It was once again the government here to help you. Now, one additional point that we'd like to raise with the court has to do with the anomalous impact of these regulations. And I think this goes to the way in which these regulations miss the constitutional mark completely that the FEC must depend on to uphold regulations of this kind. And that is that Emily's List has anomalously now been put as a non-connected and an independent committee in a position inferior to that of state and local political parties engaged in state and local elections. For example, a state and local political party under existing Federal Election Commission rules can pay up to 85% of its administrative costs with state and local money, money that states approve for use in their own elections, whereas Emily's List can never, ever pay less than 50% of hard federally financed restricted money for its administrative expenses. An even more telling example are restrictions on the payment for advertising. State and local parties can include federal candidates in their state and local advertising activity as long as the advertising does not promote, attack, support, or oppose that candidate, as long as there's not a clear electioneering message for the benefit or to the detriment of that candidate. Whereas Emily's List, as mentioned earlier, runs into these financing barriers by a mere reference to a federal candidate, regardless of whether there's an electioneering message. And I pause on this point briefly only to stress that it was, as the Supreme Court demonstrated in McConnell, the nature of political parties, both national political parties and state and local political parties, that provided the justification for the extensive soft money regulatory scheme of McCain-Feingold that the court upheld in this case. Well, Emily's List is not a political party. No one's claiming that it is. It's an independent, non-connected political committee, and yet here it's functioning under a set of rules that are really pitched more to the corruptive potential of parties and have no bearing either on the record or in theory on what Emily's List does to support state and local candidates.
Mr. Bauer, yes, let me ask you a sort of threshold question here, which is, does Emily's List have standing to challenge this administrative cost regulation? And I ask that because it appears that you've always spent more than 50%. In other words,
Your Honor, yes, this issue was raised below, and the court held that Emily's List did have standing. It has standing because even in working individual communications at the moment, it is undisputed that it is required to rewrite those communications, redraw them, and reframe them to, in effect, meet the requirements of these rules. Its speech is directly affected. It has to edit out references to federal candidates to avoid the onerous imposition of the 100% federal financing requirement. But I'd also like to answer directly your question about their history in spending money. It is unquestionably true that over the period of time that the FEC measures, Emily's List, for a variety of reasons, may well have spent within the range that the Federal Election Commission identified. But for purposes of determining the restrictions that Emily's List must live with on as a constitutional matter, what it has done in the past under one set of circumstances cannot be binding, because in the future their circumstances may well be different. There are numerous instances where Emily's List has conducted programs that are predominantly non-federal. For example, the Campaign Corps, which is a training program identified in the record, where Emily's List, both in federal and in non-federal election years, has trained campaign workers that have gone out predominantly to state and local campaigns. So you have no question there about the nexus. I have reserved additional time. I realize my time has expired.
All right. Coker.
May it please the Court, I'm David Kolker with the Federal Election Commission. There are four critical reasons why the District Court correctly upheld the regulations at issue. The first is that these regulations govern federal political committees whose major purpose is federal campaign activity. The second is that they concern contribution limits that are only subject to intermediate scrutiny. Third, that they govern mixed activity that affects federal elections as well as state elections. And fourth, that Emily's List has brought a facial challenge, but has failed to demonstrate that the regulations are substantially overbroad. With regard to the first point, in Buckley, the Supreme Court narrowed the definition of political committee so that you are only treated as a political committee under the statute if your major purpose is the nomination or election of federal candidates. And that is why the Court also said in Buckley at page 79, and I quote, expenditures of candidates and of political committees so construed can be assumed to fall within the core area sought to be addressed by Congress. They are, by definition,
the disclosure section, right? Wasn't that the disclosure section in the Buckley opinion?
Yes, it was.
And Buckley's chock full of discussion about the serious First Amendment rights of independent groups like Emily's List to make expenditures in support of candidates or in support of issues that Emily's List thinks important without regard to government regulation, right?
Yes, but the narrowing definition of political committee was also referred to in the McConnell decision when they discussed.
Of course, McConnell's really, as Mr. Bauer was saying, that's about the, taking a step back, the original problem here, right, was corruption or the appearance of corruption from contributions, large contributions to candidates and candidate committees. McConnell suggests parties, including national and the state and local parties, the candidates are often, and the office holders are often one and the same with the parties. So the same anti-corruption, anti-appearance of corruption rationale may extend to parties. At least there was a record that McConnell on a facial challenge suggested as much. When you get outside parties to independent groups, doesn't the First Amendment calculus really change quite dramatically?
Not significantly, Your Honor, and here's why. First of all, going back to the California Medical Association decision in 1981, that dealt with the contribution limits applicable to non-connected political committees like Emily's List.
Right, and Justice Blackmun's opinion's the binding opinion from that case.
Yes, but Justice Blackmun joined the majority in upholding the contribution limits. He went on to make
because the group contributed to candidates.
Yes, but what was key in that,
it's a little unclear how, and he distinguished a group that didn't contribute to candidates.
That's right.
And what's a little murky is what he would have thought in with a group that both contributed to candidates and did get out the vote.
But what's key is that for purposes of this case, he joined the plurality in upholding the contribution limits, even as to money that was going to be tagged for administrative expenses. And here what we have is, years later, obviously, we've got federal political committees whose major purpose is federal campaign activity, a reasonable 50% rule that 50% of the money has to be hard money for things like administrative expenses. So the court in California Medical Association upheld the limit with Justice Blackmun's vote, even if that money was just going to be used for administrative expenses, because they recognized that there was still a potential for corruption for these outside groups.
What about a group that spends most of its money on state and local elections? Why is the 50% allocation rational for a group like that?
Well, the point is that to be a federal political committee, your major purpose is federal campaign activity. So if the majority of their work is state and local, I'm not sure why they would be registered as a federal
commission
political
committee.
Has the
commission ever said that?
Well, the commission has said in a few places, including this regulation, that it's dealing with groups whose major purpose is federal campaign activity. I think the most recent thing that I would draw the court's attention to...
Is there a definition that suggests... if you only expend 45% of your funds on federal elections, that your major purpose is not federal election activity?
The commission hasn't developed a rule with that level of...
30% or 20% or...
Yeah. What happened, Your Honor...
There's a lot of uncertainty then.
I would say there is some uncertainty, but I think the most recent thing that the court could look to, after this rulemaking was completed, it was challenged in court, as being too permissive, and in what's known as the Shays 2 litigation, led to a remand to the commission and a further explanation of what they were doing in the rulemaking with regard to political committee status. And in this follow-up supplemental explanation and justification, which you can find at 72 Federal Register, it begins at page 5595. The jump site I would give you is at 5601. In the context of the commission explaining its views, although it did not promulgate a specific regulation about this, it did say that political committee status requires having, quote, the major purpose of engaging in federal campaign activity. And if you look at the way the commission has been applying the major purpose test in some of the matters referred to in that Federal Register notice and in subsequent matters, I think it's clear that that's how the commission has been applying it. In an AO, which is in the record before you at page 199 of the Joint Appendix, the Commission states, by their very nature, all federal political committees, not just political party committees, are focused on the influencing of federal elections.
Mr. Bauer's point that this scheme treats a group like Emily's List worse than a state or local party?
Well, I think...
which is odd given BICRA and McConnell's emphasis on parties being a particular source of concern.
Well, I think Mr. Bauer explained to you all of the things that Emily's List does. It recruits candidates. It helps them get elected. In terms of the corruption interest, they're very tied to many of these candidates. And although they can't put someone on the ballot in the same way.
Not tied in the way McConnell said.
Well, McConnell didn't address.
McConnell talked about the office holders serve and the candidates serve in the parties. They're listed on the ballot as members of the parties. They direct the selection of the officers of the parties.
Well, that's true, Your Honor.
They're at the fundraisers for the parties.
But it wasn't that McConnell said anything to disregard the corruption concern for outside groups. BICRA simply didn't enact any provisions about these kinds of non-connected political committees. But certainly the corruption concern is very much here. If you have an organization that raises as much money as Emily's List does, that brags about getting people elected, surely candidates
will
feel...
Congress was aware of this, of these kinds of groups, and chose not to regulate them.
Well, Congress started with the most important problem that it had before it, which was the national party committees. And obviously, that's what the focus of BICRA was. But nothing in BICRA suggested that...
And some members of Congress have wanted to regulate, extend BICRA to independent groups like this.
Well, the main...
But the Congress as a whole has not passed that.
I think what you're referring to, Your Honor, is the move to regulate more 527 organizations. But remember... The motivation behind that reform movement would be to make 527 organizations register with us as political committees and have to live with the limits that apply to political committees. So the thought is that the regulations for non-connected groups that nevertheless get involved in politics and federal campaigns need to have some regulation. Remember, the context of this, two things. Emily's List is not challenging the nature, the principle of allocation. They're really just challenging the particular rules that we've come up with. They prefer the old rules to the new one. So even Emily's List isn't challenging the principle of allocation. And in terms of the First Amendment, these are contribution limits. And they need to show that these rules would prevent them from amassing the funds necessary for effective advocacy, and they haven't even attempted to make that kind of a showing. Remember, in McConnell, we had the same sorts of...
When you call them contribution limits, the rules require that Emily's List pay for non-federal activities with federal funds out of its federal account.
Well, what the Supreme Court told us was that the kinds of activities we're talking about inherently affect both. They affect federal. When you do get out the vote drives for your favored party, you're helping state candidates and federal candidates. McConnell is extremely clear about that. What McConnell did when it was looking at the restrictions on both the national parties and the state parties is to explain why they were not going to apply strict scrutiny. And the reason for that is that these rules function no differently.
What about a hypothetical group that only supported, say, an Emily's List that only supported state and local candidates?
Well, I can't imagine why they would register as a federal political committee.
Well, let me ask you where that line would be drawn. Let's say a group spends $50 million influencing federal elections and $51 million influencing state elections. Would they have to register with the FEC?
I can't speak for how the commission would rule on that. I that's exactly the kind of thing that an advisory opinion, that process is set up for. I think it would depend upon, exactly what they were doing. So I can't answer that specific hypothetical. But remember, this is a facial challenge, and these regulations clearly have a plainly legitimate sweep. 98% of the non-connected committees hadn't been allocating at all, probably because, in part, the rules were relatively confusing. So for 98% of the non-connected committees, they were using all federal funds. And in that sense, these regulations are permissive because they make it easier for those committees who may have found the old procedures too difficult to use a split of soft money and hard money for their GOTV. So how, in a facial challenge, could we say that these regulations do not have a plainly legitimate sweep if for 98% of the committees that had been using all federal funds, they can now use an allocation more easily of the two? And even for the 2% of the groups or so that had been allocating, about half of those were using a 50% split to begin with, including Emily's List.
I guess this regulation was motivated by the experience of ACT or ACT, and there was some concern about that. But what about Mr. Bauer's point that the ultimate resolution of the ACT situation shows that the FEC had the tools at hand to enforce violations of the old rules and didn't need new regulatory authority?
Well, I think there's a difference between enforcing it after the fact and making sure you have rules set up that prevent it from happening in the first place. I think the experience of ACT was read more broadly, that because of the quirky way that the funds expended method went, it was very targeted to particular candidates that were named, that it lent itself to abuse.
Can I ask you what ACT was doing? This is a bit of an aside, but was it contributing directly to federal candidates?
I believe that most of its money was spent on advertising.
Issues?
I'm sorry. I believe what happened was they used advertising that only rarely mentioned federal candidates but more frequently mentioned non-federal candidates to come up with their 98% or 10%. I'm forgetting the exact number. I'm sorry.
But it did. Was it voter registration?
Yes.
Get out the vote?
Right.
Did it directly contribute to federal candidates? Do you know?
I don't remember. I think they may not have. I honestly don't remember. But the point is that they manipulated the system by making certain...
That word manipulated is a loaded term. They're an independent group who's entitled to free speech under the Constitution. What was the manipulation?
Well, Your Honor, you were asking what was the motivation for the rule. The motivation for the rule... use the less derogatory term, they carefully spent some money
okay.
to to allow themselves to then use a very high allocation of soft money. And what the commissions looked at after the fact was that the overwhelming majority of the work was influencing federal elections. And to make it simpler, for all political committees that are non-connected, let's come up with a different system, a reasonable one. The Supreme Court has said this is inherently activity that affects both federal and state elections, and prevents the kind of potential for abuse in the way the old formula had worked.
How does the FEC construe the phrase "for the purpose of influencing any election for federal office"?
Well, I think it depends upon the context, Your Honor. There's a lot of water under that bridge. In other words, in the context of independent expenditures, we go by the Supreme Court, which has said that it has to, you know, expressly advocate the election defeat of a candidate. And then, of course, we have Bicker and McConnell in electioneering communications. For contributions, we have one of the regulations that is at issue here, 100.57, where the regulation says that if a group solicits money, if that solicitation indicates that the money will be used to support or oppose the election of a candidate, then the incoming money will be deemed to be hard money contributions. And I think in the briefs, Emily's list fuzzes up the fact that it's not merely a solicitation that says a federal candidate will be supported or opposed, but the election of that candidate will be supported or opposed. So in that sense, it's very narrowly tailored to the language of the statute. I believe that my time is up.
But on the reference rule, I've been asking some bigger picture questions, but on the specifics, on the reference rule, so if there's an ad that has, or a solicitation, or that has a federal office holder or candidate suggesting that their support for a state or local office holder or candidate.
Well, if it's in the solicitation.
It's clearly, say it's in Michigan and it's a New York senator appearing in the ad for a Michigan state or local office candidate who's running, and it runs in Michigan, it's still attributed 50-50?
Well, the rules play out differently depending upon whether you're talking about a solicitation or some other kind of public communication. Mm-hmm. If it's a solicitation, if the federal candidate is just saying, give money to support the state candidate, but the solicitation doesn't indicate the money will be used to support the election of the federal candidate,
right,
then it's 100% non-federal.
Yeah, I'm not referring to the solicitation. I'm referring to the other.
Well, in the other general public communications, if they mention federal candidates, the commission called it candidate-driven. It's done by an allocation ratio of the proportion of time and space devoted to the different candidates.
But if an ad runs in Michigan, a state or local, a state candidate for governor in Michigan, and a senator from New York appears in the ad saying, please support candidate X running for governor in Michigan, and it runs only in Michigan, it still has to come out of the, at least 50%,
it would be 50-50.
50 has to come out of the federal fund, even though it has nothing to do with a federal election.
Well, a couple of comments, Your Honor. That is how the rule works. These are bright line rules. Again, this is a facial challenge. So even if there were perhaps an unconstitutional...
Does that make any sense, though?
Sure. Look, these are general rules for committees whose major purpose is federal campaign activity.
But a lot of state or local candidates around the country, right, one of the things they do are run advertisements of support from nationally known or well-known federal officials.
Well, as the district court found,
it has nothing to do with reelecting the federal candidate or official. It's all about taking that star power and using it to help the state or local get elected.
But like get out the vote drives that are generic on their face, if you have a federal candidate saying, come and vote for this person, it'll look like an ad that just says vote Democratic or vote Republican, it's likely to motivate everybody who's like-minded to vote for the whole ticket. And as the district court found, this
might be different states entirely. And that's often the case, right?
Yes, but if there really is a superstar saying, coming out.
Well, that's true in both parties, right? There are lots of superstar federal office holders who will appear around the country in every not every, but a lot of state or local candidate ads, right?
And all that I'm saying is, like generic campaign activity that would motivate everybody to support the whole ticket, there's nothing arbitrary about saying that that has to be half federal money. Thank you.
Thank you. Does Mr. Bauer have any time? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
First of all, a quick housekeeping matter. The rules work even greater injustice than I indicated with one of my examples. If you have a federal candidate endorsing ballot initiatives, even, for example, that federal candidate is not in that same state and not running for election, the financing requirement is 100% federal. Beyond that, very quickly, and I appreciate the court's indulgence with the additional time, number one, Mr. Kolker makes an extraordinary statement when he says that the First Amendment rights of non-connected independent committees under McConnell are fundamentally no different than that of parties. That flies in the face of settled constitutional doctrine, at least as it stands today. Number two, he puts an enormous amount of weight.
You'll be able to finish, I think, but can I interrupt you there?
Speed up to
yes, I know. I want to ask one question, which is he cites CalMed as being supportive of the FEC's position there. Can you deal with his response on that?
Yes. I mean, CalMed is mysteriously produced here for the FEC's position. CalMed didn't raise any of the issues in this case. CalMed was a simple question of whether a committee that was making contributions to federal candidates had to observe a limit on contributions made to that federal program. That's settled law now. That's certainly what Emily's List does. I don't think it bears at all on this invasion of our state and local programs through the promulgation of these excessive federal regulatory schemes. Furthermore, he puts a great deal of emphasis on major purpose. Here's an irony. The Federal Election Commission set out to define major purpose in the 2004 rulemaking, didn't come up with an agreement on what it was, didn't publish a definition, and is now here before this court telling us that it's a key issue here, that somehow our major purpose is defined and known, and it means that our state and local programs are sort of at risk as the FEC pleases. The fact of the matter is that political committees that spend more than $1,000 or receive more than $1,000 and have any meaningful federal election activity will typically register with the Federal Election Commission, at which point all of their state and local programs become subject to these allocation rules. And finally, I want to say one further thing about the money available to Emily's List for these state and local purposes. The FEC has suggested that Emily's List has had enough hard money to pay these state and local costs, enough federally financing money, so therefore what's the harm to us? What's the harm if we have to use the hard money to pay for state and local activities that could otherwise be paid under state law? Well, the Supreme Court in Wisconsin Right to Life made very clear the constitutional harm is not in any way mitigated by simply advising the party at issue that it can in fact spend from some other pot, that it has the funds otherwise available. That's not a legitimate constitutional analysis. And finally, the court below, and this goes to major purpose, was under the impression that Emily's List could solve the entire problem if it had a separate state and local committee, an independent state and local committee, and you could run that 100% state and local financed. That is, in fact, not the case. If Emily's List engages in any state and local activity while registered with the FEC, it is subject to the allocation rules, even if its federal election activity is only at 10 or 15% of its budget. I thank the court.